Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, owner and user of Mint Mobile. And I am recording this message on my phone. I'm literally on my Mint phone. Why? Because fancy recording studios cost money. And if we spent money on things like that, we couldn't offer you screaming deals. Like if you sign up now for 3 months, you get 3 months free on every one of your plans, even unlimited. Visit mintmobile.com/switch.
Limited time, new customer offer. Activate within 45 days. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. Unlimited customers using more than 40 gigabytes per month will experience lower speeds. Video streams at 480p. See mintmobile.com for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreenewspodcasts to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Rachel Wright, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 28th of December, these are our main stories. The Maersk shipping line says it's restarting journeys through the Red Sea despite the threat of attacks by Iranian-backed rebels.
It opens up the corridor between Europe and Asia, so it's really important to global prosperity.
The New York Times sues the artificial intelligence tool ChatGPT for using its archive, and the architect of the modern European Union, Jacques Delors, dies at 98. Also in this podcast, France's president weighs into the row over the country's most famous actor, and
the moment when I was leaving Pyongyang, I was Korean. Just outside I am mixed race, but inside I am Asian.
The girl from Equatorial Guinea who ended up in the guardianship of the North Korean leader Kim Il-sung. Just over 2 weeks ago, Maersk, the Danish shipping giant, announced it was pausing all journeys through the Red Sea after Houthi rebels based in Yemen stepped up their attacks on vessels in the area. The Houthis, which are backed by Iran and support Hamas, said they were targeting ships which they believed were heading for Israel. The Red Sea is a key shipping route because it gives access to the Suez Canal. To avoid the threat, Maersk and other companies have been redirecting some ships all the way around Africa, adding many days to their journey. But now Maersk has said it will resume Red Sea operations after a US-led coalition sent warships to patrol the area. I spoke to our business reporter, Jonathan Josephs.
Maersk have decided that they can now sail through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal because of the safety guarantees that have been provided by this international coalition of warships led by the United States called Operation Prosperity Guardian. They think that with that they can sail safely through, but they have said that they will reassess things on a case-by-case basis, that there may still be some diversions around the Cape of Good Hope, around the bottom of Africa there, but that the safety of their crew members is their number one priority. And that's in contrast to what we've heard from Hapag-Lloyd, the German shipping line, which is the fifth biggest in the world, and they think it's still not safe and that they are not going to continue sailing through the Suez Canal and that they will have to update the situation as time goes on.
That's quite a big difference in approach, isn't it?
It is, Rachel. I think what it goes to show is that there is a limited amount, though, that can be done to protect these ships. We saw on Tuesday another ship, the MSC United 8, was attacked by the Houthi rebels. They took to social media to claim responsibility, saying they struck it with a naval missile and that it was done out of solidarity with Palestinian suffering in Gaza. But that strike, despite the presence of these Western warships in the region, goes to show that security is still very fragile. MSC, the owns this ship, say that none of their crew were injured and that it was engaging with that military coalition to try and keep it safe, but even so, it wasn't able to prevent this attack from happening. this is one of the most important shipping routes in the world. According to the Egyptians who control it, it accounts for about 12% of global trade by volume. It opens up the corridor between Europe and Asia, so it's really important to global prosperity. But with these delays, we're seeing anything from 7 days for ships that are going to or from the United States East Coast to a 2-week delay for anyone that's got to go round the Cape of Good Hope and get up to the Eastern Mediterranean. And that could have a broader impact on global trade.
Well, exactly. I mean, I've seen reports that IKEA has said that they might be facing a problem with stock in the coming weeks. Is this going to have a big effect on business worldwide?
The longer it goes on, the bigger the impact, because ships were diverted at pretty short notice. And so that will cause disruption to supply chains. Companies like the French dairy manufacturer Danone have also said they're assessing the impact. So there certainly will be delays, and there could potentially be gaps on shelves in shops across Europe and potentially in America as well. Prices could go up, and at a time when inflation is still very much a concern for economies around the world, that's perhaps the last thing that many people want to see.
Jonathan Josephs. Well, since the war between Hamas and Israel began in October, there have been growing fears it could widen into a regional conflict engulfing the Middle East. On Tuesday, Israel's defense minister said his country was under attack from Gaza and the occupied West Bank to Iraq and Iran. Now, a cabinet colleague, Benny Gantz, has warned that Israel will no longer tolerate further attacks from Hezbollah fighters in southern Lebanon.
The situation on Israel's northern border demands change. The stopwatch for a diplomatic solution is running out. If the world and the Lebanese government don't act in order to prevent the firing on Israel's northern residents and to remove Hezbollah from the border, the IDF will do it.
Benny Gantz. Meanwhile, there's been no respite for the people of Gaza as Israel steps up its offensive across the enclave, shifting its focus to southern and central areas. There are reports that the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, will travel to the Middle East next week for another round of talks about the war. The US has blocked the UN Security Council from calling for a ceasefire, much to the consternation of many countries. It has, however, urged Israel to rein in its offensive in Gaza because of the huge number of civilian deaths there, more than 21,000, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. For his assessment on how President Biden is handling the crisis, here's Gary O'Donoghue.
On the world stage, Washington is finding itself increasingly isolated in its support for Israel. But recently, there's been a change in tone. It's now urging its ally to transition to a new phase of the war, targeting high-value Hamas individuals while scaling back what Joe Biden has described as indiscriminate bombing. Officials here believe their strategy of backing Israel while urging restraint has brought some limited results. There was the 7-day ceasefire and more than 100 hostages released. And aid started to flow again, though nowhere near at the levels needed to avert a humanitarian crisis. But Washington is starting to lose patience and, importantly, the administration has already lost significant support at home. A sizable majority of the American public disapproves of Joe Biden's handling of the conflict, with only around a third backing his approach. Even more worryingly for him, US policy on the war has the support of just 1 in 5 young voters, a key constituent for the president as he enters an election year. In brutal political terms, the war has also prevented the president from focusing on key domestic messages such as the economy and contributed to leaving his general approval rating below 40%.
Gary O'Donoghue. The New York Times is suing Microsoft and OpenAI, claiming they breached the paper's copyright by using its articles to train ChatGPT. The artificial intelligence tool can write essays and scripts and generate ideas as if it were a human by allowing someone to interact with digital devices as if they were communicating with another person. The New York Times is seeking billions of dollars in damages and wants Microsoft and OpenAI to stop using its materials for their models. The companies have yet to comment, but they previously said that training AI on copyrighted material amounts to fair use. I heard more from our technology reporter, Tom Gherkin.
The New York Times is claiming that millions of articles published on its website were used without its permission to make ChatGPT sort of smarter, if you like. ChatGPT works by looking at all the different things found on the internet, and it regurgitates that information, for lack of a better word. The New York Times' evidence for this is they're saying when they asked ChatGPT about certain current events, it would give them verbatim excerpts from New York Times articles. Not just the publicly available ones, but ones that are normally behind a paywall that you could only access with a subscription. That's the big allegation they're making. There are some news organisations, such as PA, which have actually reached a deal with OpenAI behind the scenes to exchange information, but how much that's worth, the remuneration rather, that's not public information. Where the New York Times tried to come to such an agreement, they weren't able to with OpenAI. So I think that's at the heart of a lot of this. It actually goes further than just this one case in terms of the media, because there are multiple lawsuits which OpenAI are facing from different people across the arts. It's not just the media. Novelist George R. R. Martin, known for the Game of Thrones, and John Grisham, they filed lawsuits against OpenAI. So is comedian Sarah Silverman. So there's quite a few different suits from people who are saying what we made, our art, has been taken.
I mean, isn't this a fundamental problem with artificial intelligence then? If it is harvesting archives of all organisations and people are able to access it for free and there's no accreditation, nobody knows where it's coming from.
Yes, and the problem that comes off the back of that is if nobody knows where it's coming from, but it is just being taken from parts of the internet, it has to be sourced somewhere, then, and this is really at the heart of what the New York Times are claiming, if people go to ChatGPT for their news or search engines powered by these artificial intelligence tools, then they won't need to go to the news websites. And of course, if that happens, there'll be less news produced by journalists such as me. So it is a problem which has to find a solution, because otherwise it'll be a mutually assured destruction.
Tom Gerken. The former head of the European Commission, Jacques Delors, has died at the age of 98. He took up the role as Europe's top civil servant in 1985 and spent the next decade pursuing his goal of federalising the bloc, often in the face of stiff opposition from British politicians. President Macron of France was among many who have paid tribute to him, describing him as a statesman who'd served as an inexhaustible architect of Europe. Chris Morris looks back at his life.
Born into a working-class family in 1925, Jacques Delors was a French technocrat and politician who became the most powerful president that the European Commission has ever seen. From the mid-1980s to the mid-90s, he was a dominant political figure in Europe, an ardent federalist who believed passionately in the need to set up a single European state to compete on a global level. Mr. Delors oversaw the creation of the European single market, and he put the plans into place for the launch of the euro. He helped make the European Union what it is today. But he also clashed repeatedly with British political leaders, in particular with Margaret Thatcher.
The President of the Commission, Mr. Delors, said at press conference the other day that he wanted the European Parliament to be the democratic body of the community, he wanted the Commission to be the executive, and he wanted the Council of Ministers to be the Senate. No! No! No!
Such was the scale of Mr. Delors' ambition and influence that he inspired one of the more memorable newspaper headlines in recent British history. The Sun summed up its feelings in three words: up yours, Delors. Towards the end of his life, Mr. Delors admitted that the design of the single currency had been flawed from the start. But that, he argued, was because there'd been too little integration in the EU, not too much.
Chris Morris. Now to an extraordinary story of an African girl's upbringing in North Korea, one of the world's most isolated and secretive states. In 1979, the first post-independence president of Equatorial Guinea, Francisco Macias Nguema, sent his seven-year-old daughter to North Korea to be educated under the guardianship of his ally, Kim Il-sung. Within months, her father was executed in a military coup and her mother became unreachable. She and her siblings were forced to live in Pyongyang. That story is now the subject of a book, Black Girl from Pyongyang, In Search of My Identity, by Monica Mathias. She spoke to James Copnell.
I was born as the youngest daughter of the first president of Equatorial Guinea, Francisco Mathias. Decolonization started, so Spain left overnight. And the country did not have any proper institution for the young Guineans to study. So Matthias decided to send young Guineans to study abroad. So while African country was gaining independence, communist countries was reaching out to Africa.
You write at one point that you sort of integrated so much that you were a black woman with a Korean soul.
Yes. Back then when we arrived, I was 6 years old. I did not have an awareness of what was going on around me. All that mattered to me was my mother. So because I was rejecting everything that is mine, which is culture, language, because of losing my mother over the night, I couldn't see her. She disappeared from my life. I gave to myself a mission to say that I must have become a Korean. So I think it was in 2 months I mastered Korean and wanted to become a Korean. I remember I was straightening my hair, never become straight. Kim Il-sung sent someone to teach me Spanish and I rejected. So it was more about rejecting the identity because of my mom leaving.
You mentioned Kim Il-sung, the Korean leader at the time.
Yes.
He was very much your protector.
Yes, because when our father sent us to North Korea, he sent us with 2 letters. One was to Kim Il-sung and the other one was to us. In that letter, he made it clear that he was sending us under Kim Il-sung guidance to look after us and he would decide which school he would send us. And once we finished the study, we should go back to Guinea in order to build the country because there was nothing after the colonization.
So the subtitle of your book is In Search of My Identity. Was that then something revealed itself to you as you carried out your research for this?
The moment when I was leaving Pyongyang, I was Korean. Just outside, I am mixed race, but inside, I am Asian. And as I was growing up, I wanted to know where I come from because all of us, we want to belong. And also myself, I wanted to know where I came from. And I started digging. And I think knowing yourself, your background, is very important because it gives you self-awareness. And when you are self-aware, you become humble. And when you're humble, whatever you do in your life, that reflects in what you do. And so identity is a really important thing and the process that I've gone through. And finally, I find myself.
Monica Matthias speaking to James Copnell. Still to come on the Global News podcast, which are the best games?
Monopoly finishes about 1/3 into the game and 2/3 of the time is spent with one person bankrupting everybody else.
Stay tuned to get tips from the author of Around the World in 80 Games. A US delegation headed by the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is meeting Mexico's President López Obrador for talks about the migrant crisis on the US southern border. In the last year, around 2 million migrants have made the trip from Central and Southern America. The border authorities have had to suspend several legal crossings to focus on processing undocumented migrants. The US wants Mexico to do more to stop the influx. A Washington reporter, Shingai Nyoka, is following the talks.
It is a very difficult time for both countries. Both sides have been overwhelmed by this record surge in irregular migrants trying to cross the border from Mexico into the US. Statistics say that about 10,000 people on average a day are crossing, and that's double the number of people that were moving from Mexico to the US pre-pandemic levels. And we currently understand that even as this meeting is underway, about 7,000 people are moving up from Mexico, from Central America, Cuba, and Venezuela, making their way through to the US. And this, according to US officials, is the single largest group of migrants, what they call a caravan, in the record. And so there are a lot of concerns by the US government about what needs to be done to ensure that the migrant crisis is resolved. And that's why this meeting is taking place now.
And what does the United States want Mexico to do?
they want Mexico to do more about slowing down that process. America has traditionally leaned on Mexico to try to reduce the number of migrants crossing the border illegally. Both sides have agreed that there's a need for additional enforcement at the border, but the Mexican president says that Mexico is doing everything that it can, that it's helping a lot on tackling migration, but what he wants to see is an agreement which is likely to include a greater commitment on aid. Mexico also wants broader issues addressed, such as the economic problems in Venezuela and in some of the Central American countries, so that migrants don't have that motive to move up to the US in search of opportunities.
Shingai Nyoka. More than 50 French actors, writers and cinema producers have signed an open letter in support of Gérard Depardieu, who faces accusations of sexual assault. There have been calls for him to be stripped of his Légion d'honneur. The letter denounces what it calls the lynching of Depardieu, one of France's most famous and most divisive actors. He denies any wrongdoing. Our reporter in the newsroom is Megan Owen.
Gérard Depardieu is one of the most famous faces of French film. The Oscar and BAFTA-nominated actor is famous for his work in over 200 films and TV series. But since 2020, he's been under investigation for rape. He also faces allegations of sexual assault and sexual harassment from over a dozen women. And a documentary released in December revealed sexual comments that he'd made to and about women. Now, he strongly denies all of the allegations, and there's no court ruling against him. Now, the French president Emmanuel Macron came under fire for a TV interview he did in December, where he defended the actor, saying that it was all a manhunt. And most recently, over 50 French actors and other A-listers have written an open letter to Le Figaro, which is a French newspaper, saying, don't cancel Gérard Depardieu. They say that it's a case of lynching. Among those who signed it are British actress Charlotte Rampling, former French First Lady and singer Carla Bruni, and Depardieu's former partner, actress Carole Bouquet. Yanni Aziadi is also one of the other actors who signed the letter.
Depardieu is part of the history of French heritage. He has left an indelible mark, so whatever you do, you won't be able to erase it. He is essential to the artistic history of our country.
The letter has sparked backlash from feminist critics and has divided opinion, including on the streets of Paris.
Why should he be protected just because he's an important figure?
It's not just one person making accusations. There are quite a few. So I don't think it's a lynching. I think there are real questions to be asked about Depardieu, who was a brilliant, sublime actor in the 70s and 80s, and who's become a real wreck.
As long as he hasn't been judged, we cannot attack him and take him down. But on the other hand, we have to stop it taking too many years for him to be brought to trial.
Depardieu himself has called the signatories courageous and has praised the letter, but mounting accusations against the actor suggest he won't be out of the spotlight anytime soon.
Megan Owen. Now, the famous Hollywood sign in Los Angeles celebrated its 100th birthday this year. Indeed, you may have heard us reporting on the landmark that's become a beacon of hope for the fame and fortune seekers in the entertainment mecca of the world. When it was originally put up, it read Hollywood Land to lure investors in the 20s. It's since seen tragedy, many facelifts and various pranks. It's also been the backdrop for countless films and television shows, a decaying reminder of silver screen excess. The BBC's Sean Lay spoke to Michael Shulman, author of Oscar Wars, A History of Hollywood in Gold, Sweat and Tears.
Like Hollywood, the sign has a kind of checkered history. So it started out as just a real estate ploy. There was a hillside community that was advertising called Hollywood Lands. In 1923, the sign said Hollywood Land, and it was only meant to be there for something like 18 months as a way to advertise. A lot of people thought it was an eyesore at first, partly because it used electric lights and it actually would flash like Hollywood Land, Hollywood Land, kind of like the Eiffel Tower in Paris. Like people sort of thought it was hideous at first. And then it kind of grew in lore and just remained for 100 years now.
And I suppose one of the things that makes that connection is that it has been the scene of tragedy.
Yes. Yeah, so in 1932, a young actress named Peg Entwistle killed herself by leaping off of the middle of the H in Hollywood land. And this just became part of the lore of the sign. It was the Depression, and they were just tons of people from all across America fleeing their little hometowns and trying to make it in Hollywood. And the fact that Peg Entwistle had sort of come to fulfill her movie dreams, and she'd been left on the cutting room floor of her big breakout movie, and her option was dropped, and then she leapt off the Hollywood sign. There's a lot more to her story, which I won't go into, and it wasn't exactly accurate. But the idea that this happened because Hollywood can lure you and then dash your dreams just became part of the Hollywood myth.
How is the industry regarded now? I mean, it was given, I think, protected status in 1973. So it's kind of had 50 happy years where people actually do look after it and kind of revere it. I wonder how the industry regards the sign now. What's your impression? Because you've talked to a lot of people in the film world for your book.
I think it's beloved, you know, and it's so interesting because its first 50 years, it was extremely not beloved. It was just deteriorating, and people would try to sort of gussy it up. To me, it's like a great symbol of Hollywood also in the sense that it's only pretty from the front, you know, and it's two-dimensional. It's like an old Hollywood movie set. If you think of like an old West town that you poke it with your finger and the whole thing falls down because it's just like a slat of wood. That's sort of what it's like to me. It's this very sort of glamorous thing that you can see from miles and miles away. I'm a New Yorker, and I'm very geographically challenged in Los Angeles, so I never know when I'm going to see it when I'm there. And whenever I do, I have to admit, I get a huge grin because it's Hollywood and it's always framed by a big boulevard of palm trees on either side.
The American writer Michael Shulman. When it first arrived in the rivers of the Bolivian Amazon, some local people feared it was a monster. Now the paichi, a very large freshwater fish, has created a major fishing industry. But while it's providing a living for hundreds of fishermen, there are fears its voracious appetite could be endangering the hundreds of different indigenous fish which throng Bolivia's rivers. Bob Howard reports on whether this invasive species is a blessing or a curse.
I'm on a fishing boat on the Yatta River in Bolivia, the landlocked South American country which, alongside nine others like Peru and Brazil, forms part of the huge Amazon basin. I'm with Johnny Nocco, a local fisherman who makes his living catching the paichi, a giant carnivorous freshwater fish which has invaded this river and others throughout the country.
When I'm in the lagoon and I see a paichi coming up for air, I have to go very slowly and not make any noise because they can hear the sound of the canoe and they escape. When it comes up for air again, that's when I throw the net.
Guillermo Ottaparum has been a fisherman for more than 50 years. He's at a paichi processing plant in the northeastern city of Riberalta to sell the fish he's just caught.
When the paichi arrived, I thought this fish was a water snake, that it would attack everything. They said that it was a wild beast and eating it would be bad for you, that it might be poisonous.
The paichi is one of the biggest freshwater fishes in the world, growing up to 4 meters in length and weighing 200 kilograms or more. Every year, it's estimated the paichi expands into another 40 kilometres of the rivers in the Amazon basin, which are some of the most diverse habitats in the world. Federico Moreno, director of the Beni Autonomous University's Centre for Aquatic Resources Research, says its size and appetite make it a serious threat to native fish stocks.
Es un pez territorial.
It is a territorial fish. It takes over a body of water and scares off the native species. It is a serious problem. The other species flee from it.
No one really knows the exact year that the paichi started to arrive in Bolivia, but it's generally believed it was the result of a breach of a paichi fish farm in Peru, where the fish are native, which led them to being released into Bolivia's rivers. Fernando Carvajal is a biologist and expert on the paichi.
During the first years of life, paichi grow at a rate of 10 kilograms a year. That means that the paichi is eating a lot of fish.
Unlike other predatory fish like the piranha, it doesn't have big razor-sharp teeth. Instead, it hoovers up fish like a giant vacuum cleaner. At the same time, it frightens off any fish which try to eat its own young. However, for local fishermen, it's been a boon. Edson Susano runs a paiche processing plant in Riberalta.
We sell it everywhere, supermarkets, markets. We buy and process around 30,000 kilograms per month.
As well as providing employment, the paiche is also a healthy form of protein for Bolivians. Scientists like Federico Moreno hope that fishing will keep paiche numbers in check and protect Bolivia's extraordinary biodiversity.
Keep fishing for them all the time, and that could keep a balance between the different species.
Federico Moreno ending that report by Bob Howard. Often when families gather over this festive period, they spend quite a lot of time playing games. For as long as there have been people, there have been games, and quite a lot of games come down to mathematics. Marcus de Sautoy is a professor of maths from Oxford University. He loves them so much, he's written a new book called Around the World in 80 Games. He told Paul Henley more.
I think it's also a way of getting to know all the places that I visit around the world for my mathematical research. Tell me the game you play and I'll tell you who you are. I think games are a wonderful insight into the culture, the people, the history of the places I visit for my work. I've been collecting games as I've traveled the world for many decades, and this book is sort of bringing all the things I've discovered on those journeys together into one volume.
There are indeed games that characterise parts of the world, aren't there? Like bits of Africa, Mancala.
Mancala is a wonderful game which I think is very distinctive to Africa, and what's interesting as well is how this game varies across the continent. So you have kind of simple versions which are just sort of two lines of pits with stones in, but you can get very complicated versions with four lines, the ability to reseed stones in. It's one of the great strategy games that humanity has come up with, I'd say alongside chess and the Chinese game of Go.
You have a special respect, don't you, for a Western family favourite, Monopoly?
Well, I absolutely hate Monopoly. I think it's a very
highly flawed game.
Well, I think it's a highly flawed game, but I can't understand why it's everyone's game of choice at this time of year. For me, one of the important factors of a game which make it a good game is that it shouldn't finish before it ends. So right up to the last moment, anybody should still be able to win. And I think Monopoly finishes about one third into the game, and two thirds of the time is spent with one person bankrupting everybody else. And it's also a very long game, which I think is also a fault for a game.
In backgammon, there is not just maths, but a heavy sprinkling of luck, isn't there?
Yeah, and I think this is important for a game. I think you need a balance of strategy and luck, because if it's just a pure strategy game, then if somebody's good at the game, they're always going to win. So that's another of my rules for a good game. It shouldn't finish before it starts. So I think having an element of luck actually allows a beginner or somebody who's a slightly weaker player a chance to win. But I don't want a game which is just pure luck, because then you can't express yourself. You want some agency. So I think backgammon is almost the perfect game for having this lovely balance between, yeah, chance is there because the throw of the dice will determine your go. But what you do with those dice also means that you're expressing your strategy. Are you an aggressive player, a risky player, defensive player? And also this game is wonderful because it's got its heritage in one of the oldest board games in history, which is a 5,000-year-old game that you can find in the British Museum in London, which comes from Mesopotamia. The other strategy game that I think is one that's fascinating from a mathematical point of view is this ancient game of Go, which is black and white stones put down on a 19 by 19 grid. It's so simple, yet the games that evolve are so complex. And it was a game that was very challenging to write code for a computer to play. And I think it's one of the examples of the impact of the new AI that we're seeing and machine learning, that it took till 2016 for a computer to really match what a human can do at this game.
Professor Marcus de Sautoy speaking to Paul Henley. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Rachel Wright. Until next time, goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreenewspodcasts to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.